In this session, Wynn Wenger will discuss with you the benefits of dream work and how to more easily remember your dreams. Wynn will tell you that, in fact, you're always dreaming, and he'll show you why. He'll show you how to tap into the power of your subconscious. You'll learn that you have more intelligence than you're actually conscious of. In this session, Wynn will also introduce you to the concept of image streaming and many examples of its powerful benefits as you begin to build a foundation for tapping into your Einstein factor.
Did you know that you're always dreaming? Not only when you're asleep, but even this very minute. Inventor Elias Howe had labored long and hard trying to invent the first sewing machine. He tried everything, but nothing was working. Exhausted, he goes to sleep. Then one night, Howe has this horrible nightmare. He was running from a band of cannibals. They were so close he could see the gleam of their spear tips. Through his terror, Howe suddenly noticed that each spear point had a hole bored in its tip, shaped exactly like the eye of a sewing needle. At that moment, he awoke, gasping with fear. Only then did Howe realize what his nightmare was trying to tell him. To make his sewing machine work, he would have to move the eye hole from the middle of the needle down to the tip. It was precisely the breakthrough he had been seeking. Thanks to Howe's dream, the sewing machine was born. There is a problem with dreams. History does abound with stories like Howe's. Dreams have inspired rulers, artists, scientists, and inventors since biblical times. But dreams do have their limitations. Dreams are notoriously hard to control. We have not yet learned how to summon them at will, although someday we might. We cannot decide in advance what we will dream about, and most of the time we forget our dreams anyway. But psychophysiologist Stephen LeBerge has tried to solve this problem through his technique of lucid dreaming. He trains people in lucid dreaming to become fully conscious while in the midst of a dream. The first step is to get into the habit of asking yourself, is this a dream? Ask that question, is this a dream, at frequent intervals throughout the day? Once that habit becomes ingrained, you will eventually remember to ask yourself that same question while you are dreaming. The first time you ask this question and the answer comes up yes, congratulations. You will have begun your first lucid dream. Lucid dreamers soon learn to control the action in their dreams and to choose the experiences that they want. Many report exhilarating episodes of soaring through the clouds, exploring underwater realms, changing in animals, and performing other amazing feats at will. They converse at length with interesting dream characters, work out neuroses, and confront fears. They can even stop a nightmare in its tracks and steer it towards a more pleasant conclusion. Interested readers should investigate LeBerge's remarkable books, Lucid Dreaming and Exploring the World of Lucid Dreaming. LeBerge's method holds great promise as a tool for unblocking unconscious riches. It does seem to come naturally to some people and much harder to others. There is always great benefit to be gained from dream work, and it never ceases to fascinate. You should supplement your arsenal with far more direct and efficient methods. Some of our methods that we are exploring together here revolve around the fact that you can dream while you're awake. In fact, you're doing so right this very minute. How do we gain access to that? How can you best gain access to this remarkable flow of inner perceptions? Over the last 30 years, I have found one useful answer. The image streaming technique I've developed opens the mind to a flow of symbolic imagery as potent as that of any dreams. But unlike dreaming, you can practice image streaming while you're wide awake, and you can do it virtually anytime, anywhere. 10 minutes of image streaming every day will suffice to induce profound positive change in your life. What is the image stream? Well, the fact is that we are always dreaming. Psychologists estimate that we spend about 50% of our time daydreaming and over 8% of it sleep dreaming. That means we spend 58% of our lives absorbed in passive reception of subconscious imagery. It sounds like a lot of time, but in fact these figures are a gross understatement. Evidence suggests that the image stream literally never ceases. Even when our minds are preoccupied with work, conversation, or other demanding tasks, the sensory mechanisms of our mind continue to generate imaginary sights, sounds, smells, tastes, feelings, all sorts of associated awarenesses, sidebands of our thoughts and perceptions. Many of these images consist of memories that are triggered by random associations, or supposedly random associations, while others are echoes or reinforcements of our conscious thoughts at the moment. This is one of the few places where the squelcher makes itself useful. If you did not squelch this ongoing image stream from consciousness, the flow of images from that would distract you from doing your job. Can we strike a balance with this? Genius does seem to be linked to the intensity of our subconscious imagery, yet to be effective, we need to strike a balance between squelcher and image stream. In striving to gain access on demand to our intense and vivid imagery, we must also preserve the ability to squelch it at appropriate times. This balance is best achieved through a controlled process like image streaming, which allows us to choose the time and place of our imaging and to remain completely conscious and alert throughout the session. We have far more ability than we commonly realize to engineer our consciousness. The phenomenon of dream recall offers one of the clearest illustrations of this ability. Some experts, such as neuroscientist Alan Hobson, maintain that when our brains enter REM sleep, they stop emitting the neurotransmitter chemicals necessary for memory. It thus becomes physiologically impossible for us to remember most of our dreams, according to Hobson. Yet you can easily demonstrate to yourself the fallacy in this theory. Try a simple experiment. Ask yourself, what were the plots of my first three dreams last night? If you're like most people, you'll not be able to recall a single dream from last night, much less three of them in a row. Indeed, many people will claim that they do not dream at all, except on rare occasions. But sleep researchers assure us that the average person has about five separate dreams each night, lasting a total of at least 2 hours. We simply forget them by the time we awake. Now try this. Before you go to sleep tonight, leave a notebook and pen by your bedside, or a little tape recorder. The instant you wake up, even if it's in the middle of your night, write down everything that you remember about your dreams. You might not have any results for the first couple of days, but I guarantee that after a couple of weeks of this exercise, you will find yourself waking up each morning with vivid, detailed memories of three or more different dreams. You will remember such an astonishing mass of material that you will soon despair of writing it all down. Doing this exercise with that tape recorder will produce the same results. I must say that within a couple of weeks of the time I started doing this as a kid, I found myself recording 20 and 30 more dreams a night, which became impractical, but I think it was an important part of my own development. And why was that important to my own development? And how can it be important to yours? You get more of what you reinforce. This well-known phenomenon illustrates what we might call the first law of behavioral psychology, that whatever you reinforce, you will get more of. Every time you write down your dreams or otherwise respond to them, you're reinforcing the behavior of remembering your dreams. Not just the dreams themselves, the behavior of remembering them. Thus, your memory of your dreams becomes stronger. Likewise, every time you fail to write down or otherwise respond to a dream, you're reinforcing the behavior of forgetting your dreams, and so your recall weakens accordingly. Image streaming works in our favor the same way. As you begin this course, your image dream is probably quite weak because you've spent your whole life ignoring and suppressing it. But as you begin daily image dreaming, you'll be startled to find your imagery growing stronger and more vivid as you're practicing. Let's look at how to image dream. The procedure of image dreaming is deceptively simple. You sit back in a comfortable chair, close your eyes, and describe aloud the flow of mental images through your mind. Three factors are completely, absolutely crucial. I call them the three commandments of image dreaming. One, you must describe the images aloud, either to another person or to a tape recorder. Describing them silently will defeat the purpose of this exercise. It has to be aloud. Two, you must use all five senses in your descriptions. If you see a snow-covered mountain, for example, don't just describe how it looks. Describe its taste, its texture, its smell, the feel of the air, the sound of the wind howling across its peak. Three, phrase all of your descriptions in the present tense. That is going on right now. You're looking at it right now. This is what you're seeing right now, as if it were still going on, and you'll get much more going on immediately in the present. We have some interesting scientific results on measuring the effects of image dreaming. Originally, I developed image dreaming as a kind of oracle on demand. The idea was that you would pose a question to your subconscious mind and receive an answer through mental imagery, much as Elias Howe received help on his sewing machine from the dream world. In fact, image dreaming has proved extremely effective for this purpose,
but image dreaming
also revealed unexpected benefits. One of image dreaming's more surprising side effects came to light in an experiment performed by physics professor Charles P. Reinert at Southwest State University in Marshall, Minnesota. Reinert asked 79 of his first-year students to take part in a test of accelerated learning techniques. During the 1988 winter quarter, some students agreed to practice the WIMBY method, a standard program of enrichment that uses word problems to build analytical skills. Others were to try an unusual new method called image streaming. Reinert administered a standard intelligence test to each student before and after the course. The results proved rather startling. In one section, students who had practiced the WIMBY method gained the equivalent of about 4/10 of an IQ point per hour of practice. But those who image streamed gained a whopping 9/10 of a point per hour, the equivalent of a full IQ point for every 80 minutes of practice. Why these results? Why intelligence gain with image streaming? Why should image streaming raise IQ? The answer lies in our brain cells. Consider what happens when we practice a new skill such as riding a bicycle. At first, it seems impossible to balance atop a two-wheeled vehicle on the move, but once we have mastered the skill, we never forget it. We can come back after 20 years of little or no practice and still remember how to ride a bike. That's because the skill of bicycle riding was imprinted on our brains in the form of a vast, intricate network spanning millions of different neurons. Such networks can be huge. Scientists at New York University trained a cat to distinguish between two doors, one with a pattern of two concentric circles on it. The cat easily learned that the door with the circles could be pushed open to reveal a bowl of cat food. But the experimenters were shocked when a radioactive brain scan revealed that the simple act of recognition and discrimination lit up 5 to 100 million of the cat's neurons at a time, a tenth of its entire brain mass. This experiment showed that the same neurons must be used for many different memory pathways and networks simultaneously. Otherwise, there'd be room for only about 10 complex tasks in the cat's entire brain. Memories are stored not in the cells themselves, but in the overall pattern of electrical signals firing between cells. How are these patterns preserved? If you stop riding a bike for 20 years, Does your brain keep firing an electrical bike riding pattern nonstop for the next 2 decades? No, of course not. Your brain would quickly burn out if it had to keep all 280 quintillion bits of your memory, including every skill that you've ever learned, lit up permanently and simultaneously. Psychologist Donald Hebb discovered in the 1940s that when two adjacent neurons get into the habit of firing signals to each other, neurochemical changes take place in both cells that make it easier for them to interact with each other than with other neurons that are not involved in the same learned activity. It's almost like on the internet where different sites that you tune into send your computer a cookie to make it easier for next time. When you learn to ride a bike, those neurons involved in the distinctive pattern of bike riding form long-lasting Hebbian connections. When you mount a bike after 20 years of non-riding, those connections are still there, still present, and the electrical impulses flow through them much as rainwater tends to flow through channels that have already been eroded or cut in the earth. Like bike riding, image streaming is a learned skill. The more we practice it, the more deeply we reinforce the millions of Hebbian connections linking certain critical portions of our brain. Later in this course, we'll explore together a couple of experiences involving. If you look at the ground under your feet, look at the ground under 1 foot, and let that represent your conscious mind, that part of the ground, and then look around at all the rest of the ground, and that's some of the rest of your resources. In other words, your conscious mind, your word box, is only a very small portion of what you have to work with. And genius is found by bringing more of what you have into contact with and into the focus of that word box. How do we get that foot covering a larger territory, or how do we bring other parts of that in? Well, as it happens, the majority of the brain works off of sensory images. Nearly all of the brain, in fact, works off of sensory images. Very little of the brain works in words. And so why not go to source? It turns out that all the time, at every moment, we are processing everything that's going on in terms of images. But it's out of consciousness because we haven't been paying attention for so long. But those images are there, and they constantly reflect the best insights we have at that moment that are available on whatever the issue is at hand or whatever is most important. Let's say you were to ask a question, or ask a question of yourself, at the very instant of asking, you have images in the back of your mind which answer that question and answer it extraordinarily well. It might take years, if ever, to get answers of the quality on some question that you get in an instant from your own imagery. We certainly have a lot more within us than we are conscious of, and consulting our own images is one easy and very direct and very rapid way of getting at our issues and answers on a very wide range of issues, problems, and questions. Our new discoveries, scientific discoveries. Einstein, which is why we call this Einsteinian-type processing, Einstein wasn't embarrassed to own up to the fact that he used his own inner imagery to come up to his discoveries, including the discovery of relativity. But Kekulé, who discovered the benzene ring, which is the basis of all chemistry, that was an imagery process, and he couldn't let on in the initial years that he was introducing the benzene ring, because had he said, "Well, I had a vision," his colleagues would have looked the other way, and the benzene ring would have gone undiscovered for another 100 years, and then somebody else got credit for it. An awful lot of the discoveries that we now enjoy the benefits of came about through exactly such imaging processes. Somebody paid attention, and we're enjoying the results, enjoying the benefits of that. I don't know where to start and where to stop in enumerating the ranges of benefits that come with the practice of image streaming. One of the more obvious, of course, is that IQ may not be the only or even maybe necessarily the best measure of intelligence, but it's an indicator, and it indicates something when people routinely gain 20 points IQ with just 25 hours practice of image streaming, as was shown recently in state university studies. Another benefit, I can guarantee that anybody who has practiced more than, say, an hour or so of image streaming need never, ever, 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 ever again suffer writer's block or artist block or any other kind of creativity block, because the imagery is sitting there waiting for them to respond to, and as they start to respond, the whole thing unfolds and flows in the direction that they are trying to move toward. Another benefit, again on the creative end, is that when you've finished writing an essay on a test, let's say, or finished writing an essay in real life in some report, and you wonder if you covered everything, all you have to do is to ask your image streaming faculties, what have I left out, and be shown that right like that. And so you're able to much more comprehensively address things than you would be able to without that. Self-esteem is, of course, another benefit, and when you find yourself working, creating some apparent miracles and doing some things that people, quote-unquote, don't normally do or aren't normally, quote-unquote, able to do, I think this is a much more substantial way to bring up self-esteem than just going around telling people that they're great or telling them that they're good. They can see that from their own achievements that they're really something special. In terms of learning, whether in the classroom or independently, but in terms of understanding anything, and the more we understand something, the more rewarding it is to see things in its light, to have our vision informed, so to speak, as we look at all sorts of things around us. So image streaming is our inbuilt personal Socratic tutor that's building our understanding every time we use it. And not only understanding of the particular things shown us, but of our capacity for understanding, in the sense that we're building contacts with the parts of the brain that are doing our understanding. And more of that more readily becomes accessible to our consciousness. It just enriches everything that we look at, everything we hear, everything we experience. There's one guy that corresponded with fairly much of late. He has been learning to play trumpet, and he used our borrowed genius process element of image streaming to learn the trumpet, and very quickly has achieved levels of proficiency which normally take years, and he's achieved it with understanding, with awareness. He understands what he's doing with the trumpet, which is something that doesn't always come with instruction. His kind of progress reminds me a little bit about the very first experiment that we had, in which we had a secretary in Washington, D.C., who had never touched the violin before. She didn't have the violin at this weekend experiment, and we didn't even refer to violin in the processes that we were doing. It's just, it was her application of the borrowed genius process, really, that we have elsewhere in this program. And the following week, she had her second lesson, and her instructor stopped her, put her through a couple of things, and re-enrolled her as a highly advanced student. And 2 weeks later, we had our second experiment, in which she came around and gave us a very nice little concert. Image streaming, incidentally, is a great way to reduce and bring down a condition of feeling over-informed or over-filled with too much information. That feeling that we sometimes get with a lot of stuff going on, or with people making demands on us, or a couple of lectures in a row that have difficult content, that feeling we sometimes get that has us thinking that we've got an overload of information. A little bit of image streaming, and that's well taken care of, because the image stream just lets things sort out and settle into place. And all of your resources come online in an orderly, resourceful, easily accessed way. So let's look at image streaming further, because there's so much incredible value to be had in that activity. As with all things in life, some people prove more naturally adept than others, and as with most endeavors, your skills wherever you start from, will improve with practice. The more immediate the feedback we get from some action, the more powerfully it shapes our subsequent behavior. This is one of the elements of this law of effect we were talking about, that you get more of what you reinforce. If we can project the activities of different regions of our brain into an external action together, working those different regions together in this external action, our sensory feedback from that external action is much faster than the internal feedback we would normally be getting between these brain regions. This faster reinforcement from outside ourselves forces a tighter, faster phase relationship between those respective regions of the brain. And so, if we can find ways, such as image streaming, which involve a wide range of different regions of the brain together in an external action, and get feedback from that action, we're able to weave our brain much more effectively together and get more effect, more intelligence, if you will, more genius, more Einstein factor from the way that your brain is working. So in our next session together, let's explore image streaming in further depth. There's so much in just this one process that can do so much for you. We want to make sure that you will be able to perform image streaming and harvest the full range of the benefits that are due you.
Now that you have an understanding of image streaming and the world of higher intelligence that it can open up for you, in this session, you'll be given some concepts and exercises that you can do before you image stream that will prepare you to gain the maximum benefits from this experience. Among them is an exercise called Velvety Smooth Breathing that will help you to adjust your breathing so you can open up and absorb the visualizations and image streaming in a powerful manner. As you'll learn later in this program, your breath is your brain's pacemaker, and in this session, your ability to pace breathing exercises will prepare you for the benefits of image streaming. You can use your guidebook to record your insights as Wynn takes you through these powerful, genius-enhancing experiences. Wynn begins now with an experiment.
Here is a little experiment I would like you to try. It takes maybe 5 minutes. And if you're already at home or in your office, you can try it now. If you're on the road, when you do get to your destination, please try this little experiment. Pick two corners or sections of the room that you are in when you do this. Two different corners of the room. Let's take a piece of paper. On one side of that paper, please write a description of the first corner that you chose. And on the other side of the paper, write a description of the second corner, but with a difference. When you describe this first corner, confine your description to terms involving color, texture, form, feel, and your sense of position in space. When you describe the second corner, use only abstract terms that have nothing to do with sensory impressions. For example, you might write, "There's a picture hanging on the wall and an upholstered chair wedged in the corner," but nothing about how those objects look or feel. Take about 5 minutes to write out your description, or if you're using a tape recorder, maybe 3 minutes will do. Now look over your results. Which description is more interesting? Which conveys more of the experience? Which puts the reader of that description more intimately in touch with the corner that's being described? Obviously, the first description is more vivid. That's because it gives the reader a greater degree of neurological contact with that corner. When you hear or read a description overflowing with vivid sensory impressions, your brain automatically starts to light up in the appropriate sensory areas, just as it lights up in a dream. The more senses you can evoke, the wider the base of neurological contact. Commingling those senses, Walt Disney was a great lover of classical music. He claimed that listening to the masters made pictures in his head. In an attempt to share this experience, Disney created Fantasia, an animated film in which classical music springs to life in a phantasmagoria of all shapes, sights, and colors. And in fact, the second installment of that film has been brought out recently and is most enjoyable. Disney's multisensory approach was designed to widen the film's neurological contact with the audience. He fervently believed that it would convey the music much more powerfully. Quote, "There are things in that music that the general public will not understand until they see things on the screen representing that music," he said. "Then they will feel the depth in that music." Many experts today believe that Disney must have been at least slightly synesthetic. This is a natural condition that occurs in a little less than 1% of the population. Evidence is growing, though, that this commingling of the senses, called synesthesia, may be a normal function of the mind that is simply suppressed in most people. Image streaming seems to draw much of its pole-bridging power from this hidden mechanism playing upon links between senses that most of us think of as quite distinct and separate. Looking further into this world of synesthetic phenomena, neurologist Richard Sidovic has spent years studying synesthetes, people who are born fully synesthetic. Such people may see golden balls when hearing a vibraphone, or a glass column when they taste spearmint. Some feel geometric shapes pressing against their skin on tasting certain foods, or even twist their bodies involuntarily into characteristic shapes in response to hearing specific words. This condition brings to mind the splashes, lines, and colors the Russian journalist Sharashevsky saw when certain words were pronounced. Sharashevsky was, in fact, a classic synesthete. While conducting a radioactive brain scan on one synesthetic subject, Sidovic was shocked to see a wholesale diversion of blood flow from the cerebral cortex as a man entered a synesthetic experience. "We have never seen anything like it," Sidovic later remarked. The cortex, or gray matter, is usually considered the most human part of the brain responsible for higher intellectual thought. Because blood was diverted from the cortex during synesthesia, Sidovic hypothesized that commingling of the senses must occur deep in the limbic portion of the brain, the instinctive portion of the brain that gives rise to primitive drives such as hunger, emotion, and sexual desire. In non-synesthetic people, the cortex acts as a squelcher, suppressing synesthesia and keeping it safely corralled in the limbic brain. On a conscious level, most of us therefore perceive sharp boundaries between the senses, but our unconscious minds apparently function in a much more fully synesthetic world. Seeing without seeing is one example. People who have been blinded by brain injury rather than by damage to the eyes or optic nerves are apparently still able to see. Their brain simply can't make sense of the visual impulses. When Dr. Anthony Marcel of Cambridge University asked blind-sighted patients to retrieve certain objects he had placed in front of them, they reached out and grabbed the objects deftly without groping or fumbling in a way that would have been impossible without sight. Other experimenters have shown that blind-sighted people can pick out specific shapes from an array of different forms on request. In a similar way, synesthetic perceptions seem to flood our cortex from the limbic brain without most of us being aware of them. The squelcher blocks these confusing signals from our consciousness, but their subtle effects nonetheless infuse our experience as unmistakably as the startling dexterity of Dr. Marcel's blindsighted patients. Such synesthetic vestiges emerge in common turns of speech, such as when we speak of the coolness of the color blue, the sweetness of a woman's voice, or the piercing quality of a sound. These metaphors make no rational sense, yet we understand them.
"Why they have music in restaurants?"
asked one synesthete. "Because it changes the taste of everything. If you select the right kind of music, everything tastes good. Surely people who work in restaurants know this." Perhaps they do. But if restaurateurs know the reason for their curiously apt choices in music, it is only unconsciously. Thus, the unending stream of unconscious perception enriches and stimulates our lives in hidden ways. As with so many other bodily functions, synesthesia does its best work in the dark, when we are totally unaware of it. But its work is critically important in our experience of image streaming. Remember that the image stream makes use of all five senses, not just sight. Your brain is wired in such a way that vision will always tend to dominate the creative process. That's all right. But when we describe mental images into a tape recorder, we should take care to include in our descriptions other senses as well, especially taste, scent, and touch, or texture, which are most often neglected. You don't have to hear your own heartbeat to know that jogging helps your cardiovascular system. Likewise, you don't need to be a synesthete to exercise your synesthetic muscles. Multisensory description builds up the neural connections between your senses and widens your neurological contact with the image stream. The effects of such exercise will be seen quickly in stronger, clearer, more solid-looking mental images. It's a matter of self-reinforcement. Remember our old friend, the law of effect, that you get more of what you reinforce. The strength and vividness of mental imagery are potentially limitless. Even a highly responsive subject, a skilled hypnotist, can induce what is called a positive hallucination, commanding the person to see and even converse with a companion who isn't really present. The hypnotist can also induce a negative hallucination wherein a real flesh-and-blood companion actually present will suddenly become invisible. Such trance-induced hallucinations draw their potency from the power of suggestion. Under hypnosis, a less suggestible subject might hallucinate a person only as a transparent, ghost-like wraith. But a profoundly suggestible person will perceive his imaginary companion as completely solid and as so realistic that if he reaches out and touches her, he will feel the warmth of her skin. Image streaming, on the other hand, does not rely upon a hypnotist's suggestion for its vividness. It's simply a self-reinforcing process. The more that you can be describing an image, the more intently your mind focuses on it. The object becomes clearer, sharper, and more solid. Your own objective observation, rather than someone else's suggestion, gives life to your image dream. Let's get started on some of this. Build your powers of description. Like any other skill, this ability is acquired through practice. The best way to break the ice is to simply start describing something. There in your office or when at home, begin with your physical surroundings. If you have a spare tape recorder beside you in the car or someone riding with you as a companion, you could be describing the road. Describe the room where you're sitting or some outdoor scene you often pass in the course of your day. It's extremely important that you describe it aloud and describe it aloud to a tape recorder or to another person. I can't say that strongly enough. Experience has shown that this image streaming procedure loses its effectiveness if you leave out this part of it especially. Think of the tape recorder as a telephone. Imagine that you are describing the scene to a friend. Your goal should be to describe that scene so richly that you literally force the reality of that scene onto your listener. When in doubt, keep talking. Don't edit. Don't worry about speaking nice sentences. If you're wondering whether to include some nuance or some trivium in your description, go ahead and describe it. There is no right way to describe something. The only mistake you can make is to hesitate, to stop, or to edit. These processes are the squelcher at work in your mind. After a few days of diligent practice at this simple descriptive practice, your ability to describe your surroundings will have vastly improved, and so also will your powers and richness of observation. As soon as you've grown comfortable with the descriptive process, the next step is to start describing scenes and pictures that aren't physically there, but which exist only in your mind. So what I would suggest is, over the next day or so, you practice several rounds of describing to a tape recorder or to another person, all sorts of things that are around you, and practice on getting the detail richly textured, so that anybody just listening even if their eyes are shut or looking somewhere else. Anyone just listening has to see and experience in all their senses the utter reality of what you're describing. This nice little exercise does more for you. The reason we like to involve all the senses in our image streaming and in some of our other work is that this will involve more of the brain, let us bring more of the brain online with where we're conscious from and trying to do things from. Maybe hundreds of studies showing that if you use several different senses in a presentation of a subject, more of it is remembered. We need to engage as much of the brain as we can, as many of the senses as we can. The main reason that image streaming does help memory to develop is that it's developing all these additional pathways of access through the brain. The memory, in every case, is 100% there, but it's the recall that's been our problem. And just because practice of image streaming engages so many different areas of the brain with consciousness, it gives us more and more ways to access. So if a particular path for accessing so-and-so's name or what happened back when, if a particular datum is blocked by one pathway, you have all these others. It's not dramatic. It's just a gradual improvement in memory function. With the more practice of image streaming, the more readily you recall things. So this is one of the benefits of image streaming, one of more than a few. Yes, it does increase memory. Our own main concern, though, is not so much memorization as understanding. And it seems to me that this is where learning should be focused, in building understanding. We're now coming to the nuts and bolts section of this course. For what is to come, you need either an extra tape recorder with blank tape that you can record your observations on, or you need somebody patient enough to listen as you describe your awarenesses and perceptions to that person. Just hearing what these procedures are is not enough. You actually have to do them. Like Marion Diamond's rats had to be playing directly with the toys and getting feedback from their own play for things to do any good, you also have to do these processes live, describing aloud your observations, either to a live listener or to a tape recorder. Please arrange to have these as we proceed through these next few experiences together. Refer to your workbook for further detail on any of these exercises. After hearing the instructions for each technique that we come across here in these next few minutes of this tape, please try out the technique live. Actually test the technique before moving on to the next portion of this tape. Step by step, make your own observations, record your own observations, and build the basis for other even better things sufficiently. How much richer will be your experience and your understanding of your own Einstein factor if you follow this advice and actually do these next few experiences as I describe them and instruct you in their use. For example, here's a very simple one. It's called velvety smooth breathing. One of the purposes of velvety smooth breathing is that imagery itself comes more easily when you are in a relaxed but alert state of mind. And one method for attaining such a relaxed but alert state of mind is velvety smooth breathing. Breathe in and out so smoothly that there's no pause between the in-breath and the out-breath. It's all part of one long, continuous, flowing breathe, like a slow, sensuous sigh that just goes on and on. No pauses between the ins and the outs, just one long, continuous breathe. And let each phase of that breathe, each breath, stroke you like you might stroke a smooth piece of velvet. Can you breathe the way that you might stroke a smooth piece of velvet, and let your breath stroke you as that smooth piece of velvet? Smooth, continuous. What does it feel like letting your breath stroke you like a long strip of sleek velvet. Your breath is a two-way street, not only because you both inhale and exhale, but because your feelings control your breathing and your breathing control your feelings. You breathe a different way when you are glad than when you are mad than when you are sad, or when you're feeling bad, or then when you're feeling good, or even feeling great. What most people don't yet know is that you can deliberately breathe in one or another of these different patterns associated with those different feelings to bring on and actually experience whatever you please of those different feelings and conditions. For example, to experience relief from some situation or feeling or condition, breathe repeatedly and slowly some great sigh of relief. Within 2 or 3 minutes doing that, you'll find yourself experiencing profound relief. Just to see how that works, let's imagine an experience of finding relief. Relief from what? Let's please imagine carrying a large bag of groceries a little bit too far. Can you get into that experience a little bit? What it would feel like carrying this large bag of groceries? You're worried if the bag's about to tear. You've carried it a little too far. It's gotten heavy. You'd hope it doesn't tear. And finally, ahead of you there, you're able finally to put this bag down on a table. And as you put that bag down on a table, give that first breath, that first sigh of relief. And when you're next ready to breathe again, make that next breath your very first breath as you're setting down that load on the table. And when you eventually get around to it again and are next ready to breathe again, make your next breath that very first breath of setting down that load of groceries on the table. And each next breath, for just a minute or so, make each next breath that very first breath, that first sigh of relief, setting down that bag of groceries on the table at long last. Maybe one or two more of those. And now compare how you're feeling now with how you were feeling a couple minutes ago. Whatever those feelings have become for you, please describe to me now, this voice on the tape, everything that you can notice of the differences in what you're feeling now compared with how you were feeling just before you began the relief breathing. Please begin describing now. Good. Let's now see what velvety smooth breathing is like. Notice that this is not a technical instruction in some formal way of breathing. Your physical breathing structure is a little different from the person next to you, and is a little different from mine. And so with that idea in mind, let's breathe very slowly, but very deeply, and see if we can get a sense of sheer luxury into the breathing. Breathe with more of your body than you normally do. Let more of your body into the pleasure of breathing. Get more of your body into the pleasure of breathing so it's almost as if you're breathing not only with your chest and stomach, but with your legs and arms and hands and feet. all of you in that act of the pleasure of breathing. Let's see if you can make your next incoming breath more pleasurable even than that one. And when you let out your breath, see if from all over your system you can just simply let go of some stuff to go out with your outgoing breath. And make your breathing slow and smooth and even, so that you breathe in your next even more pleasurable breath. And from all over with the outgoing breath, just see how much stuff you can just simply let go of. And the next incoming breath, make that even more pleasurable than the previous incoming breath. Maybe you can put a little vanilla in it, or a little peppermint, or something that makes it feel and smell really good. Breathing in this rewarding breath with all of your body. A sheer luxury of the breathing out and letting go all sorts of stuff with that breath out of your body. Even more letting go than with the previous breath. And for the next minute or so, let's see if you can make each next incoming breath even more pleasurable than the previous incoming breath. And with each next outgoing breath, see if you can just simply let go still more stuff than with the previous outgoing breath, so that you're working these two effects at the same time, each next incoming breath more pleasurable even than the breath before it. Each outgoing breath letting stuff go than with the previous outgoing breath. And build both these effects from one breath to the next over several minutes. And you can breathe up with your incoming breath and then release out whatever was between you and some deeper ranges of relaxation and comfort. Settling into deeper comfort. And let's just sort of get into that comfort mode a bit with your breathing. You've been breathing with your whole body. Now let your breath stroke your whole body like you yourself would stroke a strip of smooth velvet or silk. Real smooth, real sleek. Can you get into the pleasure of what it's like stroking that silk or that velvet? Stroking that smooth silk or velvet strip. And as you are breathing with your whole body, now let your breath stroke your whole body. Let your breath stroke you as if you are this long strip of silk or velvet. And breathe the way you would breathe if your breath was in the act of stroking you. You as this long strip of silk or velvet. Let each breath stroke you more and more smoothly, more and more sleekly, more and more pleasurably. Sink deeper into the comfort of breathing and letting your breath stroke you as a long strip of beautiful velvet. Breath after long, smooth breath. Stroke after luxurious stroke. And then kind of mentally take a photograph of the feeling. Can you imagine that? Take a kind of a mental photograph of the feeling of what you're experiencing now with this long, velvety, smooth breathing. Take that mental photograph so that you can remember this feeling the next time you return to this deeply comfortable, deeply relaxed, deeply luxurious state. Take a mental photograph of that feeling. even as you go on to do other things. And when sometime you come back, instead of doing all that breathing the first time to get to the same wonderful space, just use that mental photograph to come back to the same wonderful space. And then use your luxury breathing, your velvety smooth breathing, to deepen that state beyond where you've been this time. And so each time you come back to the state, play the mental photograph of that deepened state first, and then use the breathing to go deeper from there into still greater reaches of luxury and comfort. I call that stair-stepping, because it's a step at a time. You go to an experience by whatever means the first time, as in this case of breathing. You mentally photograph that experience. And then the next time you return to that state that you want, you play that mental photograph, restore from memory what that feeling was like, what that state was like, and then do more of the breathing or more of whatever it is you're doing to build that state, to build that state further and deeper. And so you can take this luxury, this comfort, this deep relaxation as far as you please. And now if you can record your observations of what that felt like. What did you notice? What are you feeling now that you weren't feeling before you did the velvety smooth breathing? And what else did you notice? Here is a simple, more directly imagery-involving procedure that you can only use when you're at home or at your office. Please do not use this while driving a car. Start out with velvety smooth breathing, and then with eyes closed, try to describe a familiar person or object in richly textured detail. With your eyes closed, describe maybe your mother, your child, or your spouse, or describe the Taj Mahal or some other great building, or some other special scene. Describe it so richly. Or describe the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, or some other familiar sight. But describe it in such richly textured detail that anyone listening would be forced to see what you're describing and to experience it with all their senses. If you do this with your eyes closed, you may notice something interesting happening. You may find yourself looking at some aspect or aspects of what you're describing. Now, for some of us, this is not news. For some of us, we're familiar with seeing our own mental images as we go, consciously, as you paint such a richly textured word picture that anyone listening would be forced to see, hear, smell, taste, and feel the utter sheer reality of what you're describing. And doing this with eyes closed, you may find yourself with an interesting experience going on. As distinct from a directed image such as that was, there is a much richer field of spontaneous images which we can explore. And when you are awaiting spontaneous images, you should be ready for anything. Pick up on whatever comes in your imagery, rather than being like Bob, who at first tried to suppress the image of that automobile tire of his because he thought he was supposed to see something else. You're not supposed to see anything. Imagery can come in any form. It might be a fence, a face, or a tree branch. It might be the feel of a touching hand, a whiff of gingerbread, or even an emotion. It might be as slight as a splotch of color, a few crisscrossing lines, or a pinpoint of light. Whatever comes, you just go ahead and pick up on and describe it, whether it seems to mean anything or not. It's the act of describing it which brings it into greater focus and allows you to begin to develop more contact with your Einstein factor. The important thing in working with your spontaneous imagery, which is where we get into real image streaming, is to stay alert. The moment an image or impression congeals in your awareness, describe the Dickens out of it. Many people fail at this point because they think the image must remain in their conscious view the whole time they're describing it, but this isn't the case. even if the image flickers on for a second and then disappears. You can still keep describing it from memory, just as you describe the Taj Mahal. Indeed, the very act of describing it will usually bring it back into view and show you more of it. Don't worry about accuracy either. It doesn't matter if you fudge a little bit. Feel free to enhance, exaggerate, or make up parts of your description, as long as your embellishments give the image more vividness and life. Remember to go ahead and do this fudging in all five of your senses. Sometimes noting a certain smell will provoke a visual image, or a sound will remind you of a taste. Especially when you're just starting out, such conscious meddling with the image stream may help to kickstart a truly spontaneous thought flow. We'll be exploring some image streaming just a little later.